The President of the United States goes on a comedy show to reassure America.
Security here tonight in the Ed Sullivan Theater is very tight, very tight. They even checked under my hairpiece.
That's...
Security is tighter than Joan Rivers' face.
Well...
Afghanistan is a real difficult situation. Here's what we know. The folks who killed 3,000 Americans, they were based in Afghanistan. They've been driven into the foothills and the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But they're still there.
After 8 years, they're still there. The war in Afghanistan is poised to escalate once again. Hollywood made a soundtrack for the movie Kite Runner. But Kabul 2009, is America watching? We are on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. Tuesday, September 22nd. I'm John Hockenberry in Boston at WGBH in Boston, here with Celeste Headlee down in New York.
That's right. Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, finally, Congress is getting down to business on health care. We'll go inside the back rooms to take a look at the deals going on there and the historic change coming on women in the workplace.
But first, Kristen Rouse, first lieutenant in the Army National Guard. You're deploying to Afghanistan early next year. Is that right?
That's correct, John.
Now, I think this is a really important question, and it occurred to me watching Obama on David Letterman last night. Do you think Americans understand the mission in Afghanistan right now?
Well, John, while I believe that many Americans do, particularly those from the Afghan-American community and the military community, many Americans really don't have much of a reference point for the conflict that's going on in Afghanistan, and that's been going on for the last 8 years. When I was deployed in 2006, I remember any of the news that I saw while I was deployed reflected what was going on in Iraq, which was a very important conflict at the time and continues to be. But, we didn't see any news about what was happening to us in Afghanistan at the time. And I know that even while I was in Afghanistan for 12 months, I received cards and letters asking me how things were going in Iraq. I think many Americans, didn't, at least at that time, understand that Afghanistan was a totally separate country from Iraq.
Well, Kristen, we're going to explore that reference point for Americans regarding Afghanistan. Stay with us. First, everything else you need to know this morning. Celeste?
In the headlines, heavy rains are blasting the southeast. Floods have killed at least six. The storms have hit Georgia hardest, dumping 20 inches of rain in some spots. More rain is in today's forecast as well. Other than Afghanistan, President Obama also talked about health care and the economy in that Letterman interview last night. We'll talk about that later. On the markets, they were mixed at the close yesterday. The Dow opens now next hour at 97.79. S&P starts trading at 10.65 and the NASDAQ will open at 21.38. So we've been hearing a lot from the president on television over the past few days. Do you feel like he's a little overexposed? Has he been out there too much or is he just getting started? What show should he go on next? Conan? Sesame Street? Should he get back to work in the Oval Office? Let us know what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. What do you think, John? What show is coming up next?
I think he's got his own show, the Obama show. We hear it every day.
Is he in competition with Oprah, maybe?
Maybe.
Let us know.
There are those who argue that now's the time to completely pull out of Afghanistan. There are coherent arguments for that, but there are enormous risks involved in that. There are those who say let's double down and put more troops in Afghanistan. There are good arguments for that, but also enormous risks. So one of the things that I discovered about being president is that if there was an easy answer, then somebody would have solved it and it wouldn't get to your desk.
That's President Obama last night on the Letterman show. He was taking a moment to be serious about policy in Afghanistan. The president has expressed some skepticism this week about sending more troops to Afghanistan until he's settled on the right strategy in that country. We're going to take a look at a mission in flux with former Assistant Secretary of Defense Larry Korb. But first, we're joined by Kristen Rouse. She's a lieutenant in the Army National Guard. She's scheduled to be deployed to Afghanistan for the second time. That's happening early next year. Kristen, how does it feel for you when you hear something like that from your president, and he's clearly still assessing his options? What's it like for you to be redeployed when the mission is still being reconsidered?
Well, I mean, it's a difficult challenge that lies ahead. And, I'm very proud to be a part of the changing Afghanistan policy. President Obama gave General McChrystal the task of assessing what has been going on for the last 8 years in Afghanistan. And he took, I believe it was either 60 or 90 days to complete that assessment. And now Obama President Obama needs time to assess that, that assessment to make a rational decision on really what troops are we going to place in harm's way and what are we going to have them do?
You're being placed in harm's way, and you seem relatively comfortable with it. We're also joined by Mary Galletti. Her husband, Russell, is going to be deployed to Afghanistan in January. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Are you feel like you're comfortable giving the president time to reassess in the way that Kristen is?
Yeah. I mean, I think, honestly, one has to give space for folks to reassess the situation. If not, basically, I'm going to go ahead and trust that President Obama and General McChrystal have more information than I do. I think that's a reasonable assessment or assumption. And so giving them the chance to take in that information, take in the landscape in Iraq and understand their resources, I think is a really important step because it means they'll probably be able to be more strategic with those resources.
You probably read the reports about General McChrystal's assessment that if we do not send more troops to Afghanistan, the mission will decidedly fail. How does that make you feel? Does it make you nervous that they may not send more troops? Or are you concerned?
No. I think in much of General McChrystal's assessment, as well as in his testimony to Congress, while he was up for reconfirmation, he was having a conversation with Congress and less a conversation with the president and less a conversation with his team. So while his assessment was done by his team, when he actually gets into the president's office with the president's folks and they can sit down and have a conversation about what's realistic, there's a space for a bigger discussion. So I'm not feeling like anything's really final, so it's not really a good time to be nervous.
That's Mary Galletti. She's joining us from the phone in Cleveland. Her husband, Russell's going back to going to Afghanistan in January. But, Kristen, you're going to be redeployed there early next year also. You've already been to Afghanistan, and you're hearing these discussions, and the president's been all over television. You're hearing him talking about how he's not sure he wants to send more troops. How is that for you? Are you confused about whether or not there'll be more troops going or not?
Well, first I have to say that I'm very pleased that this is a public debate and that the American public is talking passionately about Afghanistan, because for most of those 8 years that we've been in Afghanistan, there has not been intensive public debate over what troops are doing in Afghanistan and what troop levels are. The conflict in Iraq, while that was very important, definitely eclipsed the mission in Afghanistan. While many resources were placed in Iraq, the resourcing of troops and their supplies and backup was really in Afghanistan was really scaled to those resources rather than the mission at hand. It's called an economy of force, type of conflict. And so I think that what General McChrystal and what I hope President Obama are doing is looking at what is the mission at hand and how can we scale the resources to that. And really, that's going to be that's a whole new way of thinking as far as the way that we've been executing policy in Afghanistan, at least from my own personal observation.
Well, Kristen Rouse and Mary Galletti, I have to say I admire your patience, but it seems to me that you and families like yours have trusted this government on the mission in Afghanistan for 8 years. How many more years does this president get? And are you going to do 8 more years? Is there a break point here? When does the trust go away?
I think a big piece of this problem is linked to the fact that there's not a lot of clarity as to what the mission is in Afghanistan. If you were to ask the average American, what's the mission in Afghanistan, they'd probably respond, to win, which is true. However, what that means is still a little murky. Realistically, in order to have some level of victory in Afghanistan, there has to be an increased level of security, and the Afghanistan folks, citizens, need to feel like they can exist securely and happily in their own life and world without the influence of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, which is why we're there, in theory, right? So, reasonably speaking, I think he's got more time if he can clarify, or the government's got more time if they can clarify what we're doing and what the clear deliverables are.
Kristen?
That's very well said, Mary.
Well, my my company commander, who I'm going to be deploying with, actually sent me a copy of the, you know, the redacted report from General McChrystal that's been circulating, and I had time to take a look at the introduction to it, and I think what appears to me that General McChrystal is saying is that we need to be clear about that mission, number one, which is to, you know, there will be a power vacuum in Afghanistan if we pull out. And that power vacuum that existed before is what allowed the Taliban and the embedded al-Qaeda to flourish in Afghanistan and to set up those camps and to, you know, to pose a direct threat that did visit itself upon the American people. And, I think that, you know, as a private citizen, I'd like to say that, you know, I really believe that stabilizing Afghanistan, you know, providing that government with legitimate outreach and infrastructure and the ability to provide its own security is that does have a tangible effect on our national security. And I also think we have a moral obligation to fulfill the promises that we have made to the Afghan people. I think it's, you know, Afghanistan is a profoundly impoverished nation that has suffered from 30 years of warfare. Our country has been intimately involved in, you know, throughout those 30 years in funding different levels of the conflict, whether that be the Mujahideen against the Soviets or you know, whatever. That's a separate discussion, but we have been involved. And, we are a country of moral, upstanding people with a lot of resource. And, you know, I know that our country is going through a lot of challenges of its own, but we have been involved in Afghanistan, and I personally believe that we need to make good on our involvement and the promises that we've made there.
Okay, so however, we've seen the recent polls, and you probably have as well, that more than half of Americans feel like we should pull out of Afghanistan. Larry Korb joins us. He's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He joins us from Arlington, Virginia. So, Larry, you've heard what these two women are saying, and yet we have these polls showing that American citizen support for the war is dropping. And I'm wondering how that complicates the mission. Does this shorten the time frame for General McChrystal and President Obama, that they have to get something accomplished before support drops below a certain level?
Well, I think it's a problem for, obviously, it's a problem for President Obama, and if he wants to go ahead and accomplish what he has set out as his objectives, he's going to have to do almost like what he did on health care, give a speech to the American people and explain to them a couple of things. First of all, yeah, we've been there a long time, but we haven't been doing what we should have in Afghanistan. Both of General McChrystal's predecessors, General McNeil and General McKiernan, asked for more troops, and they didn't get them. The Bush administration was so, you know, focused on Iraq, and the president also, President Bush, thought things were going very well in Afghanistan. He didn't realize until 2008, you know, how bad things were. The other is to keep in mind that people are talking about more troops. And, you know, I really respect the people who are going there. Obama's already doubled the number of troops. I mean, I think people forget that. When he came in, there were roughly about 30,000 troops. They're close to 70,000 now with the decisions he's made already. So it's not as if he's still weighing whether to send more troops. The question is, do you send even more? And I think that's the real issue. What is your objective? I mean, President Bush wanted to create a democracy.
And we'll have
there
to see how that turns out in the months ahead. Larry Korb, senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information, also Kristen Rouse, first lieutenant in the Army National Guard, and Mary Galletti, whose husband is going to be deployed to Afghanistan in January.
Well, we desperately need Todd Zwillig to help us understand what's been going on down in Washington regarding health care reform, with all the Tea Party's town meetings, backroom dealing that's been going on. What is this, a thriller? Is it a romantic comedy? Is it a PBS documentary? In yesterday's episode, Todd told us about more than 500 amendments now being considered by the Senate. The horse trading begins today. Todd Zwillick, what are we expecting to see, and who's going to do what to whom this morning?
Well, good morning, John. The first thing that's going to happen is a lot of speeches. What they're going to do to us is give us a lot of speeches this morning. The committee has 23 members, 13 Democrats, 10 Republicans. Everybody gets 5 minutes for opening statements. The chairman and ranking member get more. And believe me, on health care, they're all going to use them. So that adds up to just about 2 hours just of the speechifying. I think that's going to take up most of the morning. This whole thing's going to convene in Hart 216. It's the great, big, gigantic hearing room on Capitol Hill, the same one they used for Sonia Sotomayor's confirmation hearings, the 9/11
I mean, when was the last time a Senate Finance Committee hearing was broadcast? I mean, this is wild.
Yeah. A long, long time. I've been trying to remember that, too. You know, I don't have the broadcast logs from CNN and Fox, but it's been a great big long time. As we said yesterday, I do not remember ever a legislative markup in any committee getting this kind of attention. So speeches all morning, John. They break for lunch. By the way, the Senate class photo for the 111th Congress is today. So they all got to spiff up, you know, trusting that Bernie Sanders will probably press his suit this morning, maybe for the first time. That'll be nice. Come back from the photo, and then you heard in the newscast that Max Baucus is starting to make concessions to make sure that all his Democrats are on board, or at least more of his Democrats. What that is $28 billion that's in play. This original bill, Baucus was very proud because it was supposed to reduce the deficit long-term by $49 billion, which was great. Hey, not only is it deficit neutral, over the long-term, we might actually save some money on this, on the national deficit. Well, he's giving back about $28 billion of that to try to make insurance more affordable, maybe more premium help for low- and middle-income people, more in the way of federal help for their costs, and maybe some money to lower an excise tax on Cadillac plans. That's something that unions right. wanted, because union members have expensive plans. And the last thing on that, even though this is going to make the centrists very happy, it makes the liberals, they like the fact that low- and middle-income people get more money, but look at what's really happening. They're up in arms because that's taxpayer money that eventually is going right back to insurance companies in the form of premiums. They want that public option so that right. that public money stays public.
Well, today it's about concessions on the left, and we'll talk to you tomorrow about any concessions on the right to try to get Republican support. Todd Zwillick, stay with us. We'll talk to you later on this morning.
Okay, John.
So Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, joins us now. The Federal Reserve Board meets today. Last time the Fed met, Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, we didn't know if he had a job or not. Now he's got a job. It seems to me that the Fed's creds are pretty high right now. Louise Story, good morning. And what do we look for in this Fed meeting?
Good morning. Even though Bernanke's job is secured, the Fed's role is still very much in question. Arguably, it's, you know, the most questions they've faced in decades. At the center of a lot of the financial reform debate is whether the Fed should keep all of its existing powers or get rid of them. And so one of the things we're seeing from the Fed, which is sort of unusual, is a lot of posturing. Just last week, they talked about what they're going to do for consumer protection, which they have been really criticized for. And then we heard about things they're going to do on executive compensation last week. So one thing that people will be looking for out of this meeting is just, you know, kind of what spin are they putting out about how well they do their work and what they should be in the future.
Does the Fed have the ability to fight for its power in the face of apparently the Treasury Department wanting to take some of its power away? And I love this story from your colleague Stephen Labaton that the FDIC may be permitted to borrow money from banks to help it out.
Well, that's the thing that's been interesting to me since I've been down in Washington to think about more is that all these different agencies really have their own interest. You know, sometimes you think of the executive branch as being all linked tightly to the White House, and the truth is they have their own interests, their own agendas, and that's what we're seeing with the FDIC story. You know, they have a line of credit. They have $100 billion that, you know, without asking any special permission, they could just tap from the Treasury. But, you know, it's well known that there are tensions between the head of the FDIC and the Secretary of the Treasury, and the head of the FDIC apparently doesn't want to do that. So she'd rather go to the banking sector and borrow from banks, which, you know, kind of turns the tables on what we've seen in the last year.
Right. Well, a real education in turf battling in the executive down there in Washington.
Yes.
Louise Story, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen joins us, our Takeaway sports contributor. If you stayed up last night, you saw a game. The Indianapolis Colts topped the Miami Dolphins 27-23 last night. You saw a different brand of football going back to the early days of the NFL. Ibrahim, what's going on?
You called it perfectly right there. It is old-style football. It's actually the Delaware wing tee that's probably the most similar. It's a fast-paced, lots of direction brand of option offense, where multiple players at any given point could have the ball, and it prevents.
Yeah, I mean, you hike the ball; it goes to this guy, it goes to this guy. Somebody else passes. It's really, they call it the wildcat, right?
Correct, and it presents serious challenges for a defense.
And it definitely stumped the Miami Dolphins, although they were in it to the end.
Well, the Dolphins actually were. The Dolphins had time of possession. They had like 70 or 80 minutes in the game of time of possession. They controlled the most of the game. The problem is that the Dolphins never had a big play. They didn't break anything wide open. And the Indianapolis Colts they had the ball under 15 minutes, which usually means you're going to lose the game. But they were surprised.
That's what's so interesting here. I mean, the Wildcat, which is what the Miami Dolphins were using, really gave them control of the ball, but not control of the game.
Which, exactly. They had more yards per play with the Wildcat than they had with a traditional offense. But at the end of the game, when they really needed to score, they put Chad Pennington behind center, and they actually had a chance in the very end. The receiver for the Dolphins had his hands on the ball, and he couldn't catch it in the end zone.
Yeah, that was it. That was a real heartbreaker. I guess the other takeaway from this game last night is in the fourth quarter, you give the ball to a Manning. Peyton Manning did it for the Colts. Eli Manning did it for the Giants on Sunday. What do you think?
They're definitely bred, it seems like, to make that happen in that critical moment in time. But Peyton Manning is the older brother, and he is like ice and steel at the end of a football game. He's going to complete passes. And the one word for him and the entire Colts offense was efficient. They had the ball under 15 minutes, and they scored. It literally seemed like they were just scoring every time they had the ball, particularly in the end of the game when they made it happen when they needed to.
Now, the question really is on this Wildcat offense. Anybody else going to use it?
I think the Eagles should use it because they got a guy named Michael Vick, but I'm not sure if anyone else is going to pick it up.
All right, so it'll be a Dolphins signature, but the question is, will they even make it into the postseason? Again, the Miami Dolphins lost to the Indianapolis Colts. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much.
Good morning.
Coming up, guess who's taking the lead in the fight against climate change? Here's a hint, it's not the United States. We're going to talk about that more in just a few minutes. But first, it's 33 minutes after the hour. Let's check in on some of today's top stories. Heavy rains have been slamming the southeastern United States with floods killing at least 6 people. Carla McClendon lives just outside Atlanta.
You don't think that it can be as strong to take a whole house away and just sweep it around, or, you know, have a car going over a bridge and just take that car and just swing it like it's nothing.
There's no relief in sight yet. More rain is expected there today.
They won't be talking about the weather, but they will be talking about climate change. President Obama goes to the United Nations today to meet with Chinese, Israeli, and Palestinian leaders. He's also giving a speech on climate change next hour, and we'll talk about that issue in just a moment. Federal officials say a Colorado man in custody may have been plotting to set off backpack bombs on New York City subway trains. Transit officials across the country are being warned to step up patrols. The man is charged with lying to terror investigators. Those are just some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, it's been a cat and mouse game for about 9 months, but today President Obama will meet face to face with China's President Hu Jintao. And some interesting words from the UN climate chief, Ivo de Boa. He said something that might seem counter to what you think about China and climate change.
China and India have announced very ambitious national climate change plans. In the case of China, so ambitious that it could well become the front runner in the fight to address climate change.
That's right. De Boa told the Associated Press yesterday China is leaping ahead of the U.S. with domestic plans for energy efficiency, renewable sources of power, cuts in vehicle pollution, and closures of dirty plants. I'm here with David Biello, Scientific American's associate editor for the Environment and Energy. David, we've been hearing for a long time that China is the stick in the gears keeping us from moving forward on climate change. So what happened?
Well, certainly they're still the world's number one polluter and probably will be for a very long time. But what's happened is the central government has really gotten the message on climate change, that it's a big issue, that it's going to impact them directly, particularly through drought and the loss of glaciers, things like that. And they want to move on it. They don't want to be seen as kind of the laggard in these climate change
areas.
Which
is how they've been seen.
That's how they've been seen, and they've been kind of criticized for their heavy emissions. Now, they have a couple counterarguments for that, but they are stepping forward with a very ambitious plan to build a ton of renewables, energy efficiency, as you noted, which has a long way to go in China. But that said, they'll still be the number one emitter at the end of the day.
Well, now the U.S. legislators have actually used China as the excuse as to why we have not passed legislation to reduce greenhouse gases. They've said, look, if China doesn't do it, then we can't because it's anti-competitive. So is this going to move the U.S.?
That's a question for your legislators. I think that, you know, it's pretty obvious now that China has moved, and that excuse doesn't hold as much water as it used to. You know, certain elements in our own national conversation don't want to take action on climate change. They've used China and India and other developing countries as an excuse, and that excuse no longer holds water.
Although, David Biello, that this hands them an argument in the sense that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in China in that it's a very inefficient manufacturing base, unlike in some of the more industrialized countries. Can't the U.S. and Western Europe say, we'll wait for the Chinese and the Indians to catch up before we do anything substantive?
They can say that, but then that will put them in the position of being the climate change bad guys. And that's not a position that typically the U.S. and Europe like to be in. Europe in particular likes to be a trendsetter in this. And the present administration, at least on the campaign trail, talked a lot about how climate change was a top priority and that we need to avoid this issue. Now, there are all sorts of competitive issues surrounding climate change, not the least of which is it's pegged to be the next big business opportunity. And whichever countries kind of move first will probably dominate that space. And right now, China is moving more aggressively than the U.S. to dominate that space.
Now, President Obama has talked a lot about using renewable energy industries to stimulate the economy. And as we talked about earlier, he's actually going to meet with China's president today. Are we expecting them to talk about these competitive issues over these industries?
I imagine they will talk about these issues. It's an area where the U.S. and China can have a lot of cooperation. Obviously, a lot of U.S. companies want to take advantage of the major opportunities in China, and actually there are Chinese companies that want to take advantage of the major opportunities that are appearing in the U.S. Solar panel makers in China are kind of leading the world. We've ceded that advantage to them, and they're coming back to the U.S. To take advantage of our new solar incentives.
So what is the U.S. Hoping to gain a market for in China?
We are hoping to get into the market for coal, cleaning up their inefficient coal plants, which you mentioned, Mr. Hockenberry, and we are also hoping to get in the business of building nuclear plants for them. There's all kinds of kind of industrial kit that we can sell to them. The only problem—
But isn't there some tension right in there in the sense that the experience we've had with intellectual property in China sets the stage for why should American companies share environmental technology and climate change technology with China? They'll just rip it off.
That's exactly the issue, and that's what I was going to get to. Technology transfer is a very tricky issue. The Chinese have proven to be past masters of what's called reverse engineering, and that's kind of taking a piece of industrial equipment and figuring out how it works and then building a version of it and saying, hey, we have our own version. We don't need to buy yours anymore. And that's a big reason why some of the major kind of industrial companies of the Western world don't really want to do business in China on large industrial kit because they're worried about this reverse engineering problem. The solution to that is difficult to say. The Chinese government is certainly making the right noises about that, but the reality on the ground could prove to be quite different.
So do you think they're sincere?
I absolutely think that the central government is sincere. The reality is, though, there are, you know, 1.6 billion people in China, and it's almost impossible for the Chinese central government to control all of them.
So when you hear the gentleman from the UN saying that they could leap ahead on climate change, do you think he's talking about in terms of improvement, or do you think he's actually talking about in terms of innovations?
I think he's talking about improvement because China has been so dirty for so long, and that's how they've powered their development. Now is the opportunity for them to, as you said, take the low-hanging fruit and improve their energy efficiency, build new, more efficient power plants, all that kind of good stuff that will really make a dent in their greenhouse gas pollution problem.
So if the United States then becomes the bad guy on climate change, as you said before, I mean, it could very well be that if China is moving ahead and Europe, we know, already has the will to move ahead, that the U.S. could be in the position of holding up climate change. Have we heard any? Obama has not made any major policy statements about climate change.
That's right. That's exactly where we are. We are in the spotlight. We are the bad guy right now. And surprisingly, perhaps, Obama hasn't said word one about climate change since taking office. That puts him in distinction to our most recent past president, Bush, who had already spoken, I think, three or four times
on climate change. But mostly to say we're not going to do anything.
Mostly to announce policies that we're probably not good for the climate. But still, he was talking about it.
David Biello is the associate editor for Energy and the Environment at Scientific American Magazine. We'll be listening today as President Obama and Hu Jintao speak on those topics. Thanks. Coming up, there's a gender divide when it comes to who's getting laid off and who's going into the workforce. What does it mean? More on that in 10 minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. So the President Obama has been working hard to recapture the debate on health care reform. He appeared late night with David Letterman last night, capping a frenzied 2 days of media blitzing. Here's the president in one of his lighter moments last night.
I worry a little bit when they get to be teenagers, right? Mm-hmm. I suppose they'll want to go out on dates, and I'll have all these men with guns surrounding them.
But he didn't talk just about his daughters and dating last night. He had a lot of serious topics to cover. And joining us are two people who were there in the live studio audience last night. Fernando de Guia is an Obama supporter from Staten Island. We are also joined by Joanne Morgan. Joanne, you are less sure of the president's position. You're visiting New York from Qatar.
Yes, that's correct.
Where you live with your husband. So, Joanne, let's start with you. What did you think after you left the show last night?
Well, I was a little bit disappointed because I anticipated some sort of questions we had asked the CBS people who were standing there. Are we going to be able to ask any questions? And they said, yes, you could put them on a card, and I guess that did not happen. So I was rather disappointed because it was an hour of his rhetoric that he's been trying to sell to the public for a while now.
And Fernando, did you have kind of the same reaction, that it was all stuff that you'd heard before?
Yeah, it was. But I was disappointed as well that we didn't get to ask questions. However, it left me a little bit more energized, because to see him live speak in front of an audience, having supported him during the election, now I wanted – and staying away from the debates over the past few months, because it was something that was just – you know, there was just so much of it going on. I just wanted to stay away. And then seeing him live talking about it some more, it's like, wow, this is going to affect me.
Stayed away from the healthcare debates.
Yes.
They just too bitter for you?
No, I think for the first couple months, you know, okay, let's get the information. And then it was the same thing over and over again. Also, the time frame is like, okay, well, when is this actually going to affect me? Well, it's not going to affect me. It's going to be a debate for the rest of the year. When is something actually going to happen? And then, when the resolution comes out, or when all these details come out, let me read up on it then.
And you felt more a sense of urgency from the president last night?
Yes, I did.
What about you, Joanne? You're making a face.
I'm sorry. No, I don't think there was any urgency. I think he's trying to sell us that. I think privatized insurance is out at this point, and that's a scary thought, because I want to have a choice in what happens. I am not a natural born citizen. I'm a naturalized citizen of this country, and I think that understanding the health care that he tries to promote in Canada and in Europe is totally false, because those people are all paying 55 to 65% of their taxes, and their health care is not great.
Did you think he was funny?
No, and I don't think, you see, I think his agenda should be a serious thing.
Comedic value. No. Fernando, did you think he was funny?
I think he engaged the audience and Dave a little bit. Yeah, I think he kept up his sense of humor that, you know, there are serious issues going on in the world, but, you know, life goes on and you have to laugh at them.
Fernando de Guia, Letterman audience member from last night, also an Obama supporter. And we have Obama skeptic Joanne Morgan. She was also in the audience in the David Letterman show last night. Thanks to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, the recession has changed the face of the workforce. More and more women are outnumbering men in the workplace. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. We're also talking about President Obama this morning and how after his media blitz, he may be a little overexposed, or maybe he's just getting going on TV.
Most Americans, when surveyed, don't know who their officials are on all levels of government. So it's only to the good that Mr. Obama appears in in as many TV shows as possible. And if he wants to appear on Sesame Street, hey, I think he'd have a great time with Elmo.
Do you think he should show up on other shows on television? Maybe 24 or The Price is Right was suggested earlier. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following this morning. Heavy rains are blasting the southeast, flooding rivers and roadways. More rain is on the way. Six are dead in the region. The Atlanta area is getting some of the deepest flooding. Fresh from his interview on Letterman, President Obama turns his attention to the Middle East peace process today. He's in New York for a key UN meeting. While there, he's holding talks with Israeli and Palestinian leaders.
Next hour, the president gives a speech on climate change at the United Nations. Also at the UN, global airlines will present a plan to cut carbon emissions in half by the year 2050. We've been talking about Afghanistan all morning. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the mission depends on maybe a little bit of nation building. In Afghanistan, the election is still in dispute.
We don't even know yet who will be the president of Afghanistan.
In other news from Afghanistan, a roadside bomb has killed another American service member in that country. And back in the U.S., smoking bans in restaurants and public places may be reducing heart attacks. New research says heart attack rates dropped about 17% in the first year after those smoking bans. These are some of the news stories we're following this morning. So, for our workplace discussion today, we welcome Beth Koblenner, Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. She's in the studio down in New York, and Sharon Mears was a Goldman Sachs executive, managing director for 16 years, a co-author of Getting to 50-50, How Working Couples Can Have It All by Sharing It All. Good morning to you both.
Hi, John.
Good morning.
So Beth and Sharon, here's the question I want to ask you. For most of their working lives, probably all of their working lives, women have had to deal with the famous glass ceiling, your eyes so far and then no farther. But in this recession, men are dealing with an earthquake on the floor. Nearly 80% of people laid off in the recent recession are men. I'm wondering, based on what you're seeing, do you think the overall relationship between men and women in the workplace and the proportion of men to women in the workplace is going to permanently change because of this recession, Beth?
Well, we don't know if it's permanently going to change, but we certainly are seeing major change. As of November, it's expected that for the first time ever, there'll be more women than men in the workplace, which is sort of this, you know, dramatic revolution that's been taking place, but nobody's really talking about it that much. Also, we're seeing that more married women have unemployed husbands than ever before. A record 21% of married women have unemployed husbands. Husbands aren't working. So the question is, are we going to start seeing the real Mr. Moms, men, you know, doing the laundry and taking all those household jobs, whereas women are...
That'd be great.
That would be great.
Yeah, that'd be lovely. Yeah.
But, you know, when you look at the numbers, right now, 97% of all primary caretakers are women.
Still.
So,
wow.
Still. So I think there's this sort of notion of, wow, this is great for women. Is this, you know, even though it's been a very tough time for men, is this good for sort of women and the fact that they're still earning 77 cents for every dollar men are, will that change? And I'm afraid the answer may be no. I think maybe everybody's wages now are going to start coming down.
Well, Sharon Mears, what are you seeing? I mean, do you think there are permanent changes? Any positive opportunities for women in this environment?
Well, I think, as Beth says, the change isn't going to come from this alone because the numbers are saying 80% of job losses are male, and it's largely because they were in more vulnerable, high-earning positions. So women are getting to keep their jobs as nurses and teachers, which are great jobs, but typically are part of the equation that has women earning less than men for the same hours of work. But what I think is good about this is a reminder that women really matter as breadwinners, that families rely on women's ability to earn a good wage. And we often forget that, and that often isn't part of the debate when we think about how we get more women to the top and more women involved in making the kind of policies that would change women feeling like they have to be the primary caregivers at home.
Well, that's the question that I have, Beth. Doesn't this sounds like a raw deal for women, because we're right. the ones that are out working all day and then we're still coming home and taking care of the house and the kids? This sounds like a step back.
Right. At first I was celebrating. I'm like, oh, this is great. You know, this is finally, will there be this power shift? Will there be, you know, women will no longer be a minority in the workplace? And then I thought, wait a second, you know, that just means you're going to be under more pressure and doing even more. So I think we are seeing, to be fair, many more men now in situations, if they're married and they have kids and the wife is working, the husband will be the one taking care of the kids. I think we'll see that happen incrementally. But economists are telling me that when the economy does turn around, that we may see that shift back, that women tend to not work if they can afford to. I mean, one group we're forgetting completely is the 20% of families that are headed by single household, you know, single women. And that's a group that doesn't have the luxury of saying, gee, I, you know, don't feel like work, you know, I can't work, or right. I don't want to work if the economy's good.
Well, actually, getting to 50-50, our book, one of the things we talk about were some surprising statistics that among married women, if you look at women from the lowest income quartile to the highest, more or less the same percentage of women don't work when they become mothers. It's about a third. So this idea that it's just about whether you can afford to work, mm-hmm. We came to believe there's something much more complicated. It's about, it's cultural. It's whether people believe that it's good for moms to work. And a lot of that relates to what we're talking about, which is helping men understand how valuable it is for husbands to have a wife with a good income, and how much men need to contribute to taking care of kids and taking care of the household so that women can be freed up to have those good jobs. And that's what we talked
Sharon,
about.
Well, Sharon, let's explore that a little bit. I mean, what do men have to put aside, what do couples have to put aside about the myths of being a healthy married couple to actually do what you say in the book working couples can do if they share it all?
Well, one big surprise for me was a 2006 study that the University of Chicago published, and it said that over the last 20 years, if you look at the data, the couples with the lowest divorce risks with the highest probability of staying married are the couples who most evenly share both earning and housework. So the idea that, you know, having a traditional setup where the priority for making money is on the man and the woman takes over the traditional role of nurturing and is not so engaged in making money, turns out to result in higher divorce risk.
Right.
And
well, I mean, that it sort of makes sense, but it's a sort of a life or death issue in a recession where couples really need to have two incomes to maintain their quality of life. Sharon Mears, just hold on there, Goldman Sachs executive, co-author of the book Getting to 50-50, How Working Couples Can Have It All by Sharing It All. Beth, before we go, we've got to talk about people entering the workforce, mm-hmm. young people who aren't married, who aren't couples. What are these big changes between men and women in the workplace going to mean for people entering the workforce for the first time?
It's hard to know, but there are some very positive studies that I came across. For example, women bosses tend to fight harder for their lower-level employees than men. A Harvard study showed that women get 18% more for their workers than male bosses do. So
wow.
Maybe you'll have an advocate out there fighting for you a little harder. That's one.
All right, and of course, the low pay scale helps the managers keep their budget down, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one reason you say, "Oh, how great! Women did much better during this recession." That's because they're making less money, so they're, you know, people are being laid off who are making the higher income. So it's a sort of dual-edged sword there.
Well, the takeaway is some changes to the glass ceiling, but maybe not permanent changes in the recession. Sharon Mears, co-author of Getting to 50-50, How Working Couples Can Have It All by Sharing It All, and of course, our dear friend Beth Koblinder, takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Thanks to Sharon and Beth.
So, John, after being all over the airwaves for several days, you might think President Obama is a little bit overexposed, or maybe you think this is the beginning of even more TV appearances. What show should he go on next? Conan? Or scrap the shows and get back to the White House? Don emails us. He says, overexposed. At the risk of letting his 24/7 critics get the best of him of the debate, Obama is doing what he does best, Don writes. Promote honest and civil argument while reaching out to viewing Americans. Tell us what you
think.
Top
Chef. He should do Top Chef.
Oh, that would be great. I wonder what he cooks. What's his favorite recipe?
Yeah, there you go.
Which is different than what he cooks best.
Runway.
Project Runway.
Yeah.
Tell us what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. The president did spend a fair amount of time on Letterman talking about Afghanistan. Here's your takeaway from someone who'll be deployed there.
What General McChrystal and what I hope President Obama are doing is looking at what is the mission at hand and how can we scale the resources to that. And really, that's a whole new way of thinking as far as the way that we've been executing policy in Afghanistan.
Kristen Rouse, First Lieutenant in the Army National Guard.
I'm John Hockenberry at WGBH Boston.
I'm Celeste Headley in New York. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
President Obama pulled in good ratings for Dave Letterman last night, but bad returns for the guy pushing a food cart across the street. Security kicked sidewalk vendor Awad Awad out to make way for the president.
I have to leave, so I can't do nothing, you know. I lost $100. That's okay. I don't mind. I leave early and I go home watch TV.
The president is here tonight. I underwent 3 hours of frisking.
Woo!
Did Obama serve up a compelling case for a health overhaul? We'll have that and extra hot sauce on that falafel, Awad. Healthcare. Eat up. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 22nd. I'm Celeste Headley in New York, joined by John Hockenberry from WGBH in Boston.
Good morning from Boston, Celeste. Coming up this hour, guess who's the most powerful Republican senator in the healthcare debate? We'll find out. The NBA has a problem with its referees and surprising numbers on dementia. The numbers of people affected could double in 20 years.
But first, Delana Dixon is a TV blogger and founder of DelanaDixon.com. Delana, what's your rating of Obama on Letterman yesterday? Good TV or was it a stupid pet trick?
No, I actually think that it was really good TV. He got a chance to prove that he's a devoted family man, that he's a sometimes comedian, and he got to touch on its political issues. So, yeah, I think it was a success.
A top rating from Delana Dixon. We'll have more from you in a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, massive flooding, Celeste, across the southeast has killed at least six, most of them around Atlanta. Georgia's top forecaster calls the rains historic, and more rain is on the way. President Obama will address climate change today at the United Nations. He's set to speak in just a few minutes. We're also expecting China to make a big announcement on cutting greenhouse gases. The climate speech kicks off a busy day for the president. He's meeting with China's President Hu Jintao, and he'll also talk about the Mideast peace process with Israeli and Palestinian leaders.
Security officials say Colorado man held as part of a terror probe may have plotted with others to attack New York trains. Mass transit officials across the country have been warned to step up security. The man is held on charges of lying to investigators. On Capitol Hill, challengers to Senator Max Baucus' health care bill are set to push for more concessions today. The Senate Finance Committee considers a new version of that bill. The Obama administration is warning insurance companies they could face legal action for allegedly trying to scare seniors with misleading information on health care reform. The warning was sent to firms that sell private Medicare coverage to seniors. And new census data show people are stuck in traffic longer. They're also less likely to change cities and more inclined to put off marriage and buying a house.
Because they're stuck in traffic?
I love that. Mixed day on Wall
That's
Street.
That's what it sounds like.
A mixed day on Wall Street yesterday. Maybe we shouldn't have put those two together. The Dow opens at 97.79. The S&P trades at 10.65. The NASDAQ begins at 21.38. So what do you think out there? Do you think the president has been on TV a bit too much? Or what show should he go on next?
John from Long Island, and I think President Obama should be a guest host on The Price is Right with a healthcare theme.
$10 copays, what's that worth to you? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. John, what show should the
Cat
president...
Cat scanners, come on down. I love that.
That's right.
That's
Doctors,
great.
A hand surgery for $25. Anyone, any takers?
Price is wrong in healthcare, that's for sure.
877-8-MY-TAKE or an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. So why did President Obama go on David Letterman last night?
Number three, honestly, number three, I have no idea. Number two said yes without thinking, like Bush did with Iraq. And... and the number one reason President Obama agreed to appear on The Late Show, wanted to congratulate Dave on the big Emmy win. There you go.
President Barack Obama became the first sitting president to grace the fabled couches of The Late Show with David Letterman last night. And how'd he do? We're here with Jeff Zeleny, White House correspondent for The New York Times, and our friend, television reviewer Delana Dixon. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So for those who did not watch the president's appearance last night, Jeff, let's start with you. What were some of the highlights?
I think the biggest highlight was, I mean, for the last at least week or more, we've been talking about, you know, are all these protests and all these criticisms against the president racial in nature? So President Obama really answered that in his most direct and kind of funny way yesterday and said, you know...
Here's what he said.
Within the last week, a couple of days ago, Jimmy Carter started talking about this behavior and was speculating that perhaps this unease or poor decorum was because people was rooted in racism. Is he onto something there, or is that just something to talk about?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to realize that I was actually black before the election. So,
Jeff, you felt like that was a direct answer, and he added some comedic value to it as well?
Well, sure. I mean, and it gets exactly to the point that the White House has been making. Like, look, everyone was obviously not a racist or against him, or he wouldn't have been elected in the first place. His election was sort of a big deal. So I think seeing him address it like that, it's actually part of a strategy by the White House that they used in the campaign as well, that he does his best for the job when he goes right to camera and does things himself. So last night he didn't look threatening, he didn't look scary, he didn't look menacing. He was funny. I think that was a on purpose by the White House.
So he was greeted by a standing ovation from the audience. Jeff, does that help him politically? Does that help him in opinion polls?
Well, look, I don't think anything like that helps him necessarily politically, but I think the whole thing looks like he's in motion and looks like he's doing something. That was the main reason that he went on all those Sunday shows, to look like he's at least doing something, because really the health care debate now is going on sort of behind closed doors. He's done in some respects all he can in terms of explaining. So simply by being on Letterman last night, was designed to remind the people, you know, who voted for him or who liked him at the time, you know, that he's kind of still the same guy. So, and he was in New York City for the UN General Assembly meeting all week. So this was something that they thought, you know, we've done
might
all the
well
morning shows,
by.
So let's finish it up and do the evening show.
So, Delana, was it worth staying up for?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Just to see him get that heart-shaped potato was worth staying up for. But I agree. I definitely think that he went on the Letterman show to, one, reach a different audience. Letterman set up a system for him that was comfortable. It was non-threatening. He got a chance to show that he really is a dedicated family man. We heard about his summer dealing with his girls. He didn't get a chance to goof off like they did. So it made him an everyday guy. We were reminded of why we voted for him in the first place, because he's just a nice guy that we like. And he had a lot of opportunities to show some comedy.
Well, we spoke with a couple of the audience members from the Letterman show last night, and Joanne Morgan had said that she felt like he didn't really talk about specific policy issues. Was that a pretty fair criticism?
Yeah, he didn't. Towards the end of the show, he had an opportunity to talk more about his policies, but I don't think he went on the Letterman show to talk about hard-hitting politics. He had done that 5 days, you know, five shows before, the day before, so this wasn't the place for him to really get into hard-hitting news. It was really an opportunity for him to just have some fun, show his lighthearted side, show that he's a family man, and that's what it really was about. On Letterman's show, people are watching for some fun, for some entertainment, not necessarily going there to see this hard-hitting political stance that Obama would take.
Well, that raises the meta issue here, and it's great to have both of you on the show. Delana Dixon, you're a TV reviewer. Mm-hmm. Jeff Zeleny, you're a White House reporter for The New York Times. Maybe the only real message here, Jeff Zeleny, is, hey, people see the president on David Letterman. I mean, how bad can things be? I mean, he'd be in the Situation Room if things were bad. He's hanging out with Letterman. That's the real message here, and the only one.
I think that's one of the messages, no question about it, is that, you know, the economy is getting better, you know, the things. I think you saw him smiling. One of the things that during the campaign that the his advisors liked to have him do was see him smiling, see him having fun like that. So I think there's no question that there was definitely a reassuring element to it. But he did talk a little substance on the Afghanistan front. He, you know, sort of repeated what he said. He said he'll be asking some very hard questions before sending more troops there. So I think there was a serious side, but no question. Seeing him on there shows that, okay, you know, he's not sort of in the bunker, if you will.
So, Jeff, we also heard him addressing the question about whether he's angered by all of some of the harsh criticism, and this is what he had to say about that.
Whenever a president tries to bring about significant changes, particularly during times of economic unease, then there is a certain segment of the population that gets very riled up. And it happened. FDR was called a socialist and a communist. You know, JFK, there were all kinds of names hurled at him. Ronald Reagan, when he came into office, he was moving in a different direction, and people were sure that he was bringing the country down. And so this is not untypical. One of the things you sign up for in politics is folks yell at you.
So, Jeff, what did you take away from that?
Well, I think the main point that he was making there, which he's made before, is that, look, he's not the only president who's been criticized. He was trying to place himself in history, actually, with some presidents who have had success. He didn't necessarily mention any presidents who have had major failures. So he was just trying to basically say, okay, look, let's take a deep breath here. I'm hardly the first person to experience people who don't like me. You know, he mentioned Ronald Reagan as well. So I think he is just trying to put a little perspective on all this hysteria, which perhaps place it in context a little bit, and basically say, look, a while from now, maybe years from now, that at this moment will be looked back on as not that big a deal, and there might be something accomplished.
So, Delaney, what do you think? We've been seeing on TV, a lot of what we've been seeing on TV is very rancorous town halls, a lot of yelling and screaming and protesting and angry posters held up outside. And do you think that this message here on David Letterman of, you know, everyone chill out, relax, this has happened before, did that play?
Yeah, that's exactly what the president wanted to get across yesterday, that this hasn't been an isolated incident just happening to him, especially being a black man. This has happened to presidents before. Anytime someone tries to bring change to the White House, people are going to get upset and riled, and he's ready for it. He knows people are going to yell at him, and he accepts it. So that's exactly
what
he said last night.
I think there's something delusional about this, though. Glenn Beck is on the front of Time magazine this week for Obama to pretend everything's fine when people are dying in Afghanistan. That's a high-risk strategy, don't you think, Jeff?
Well, I guess it could be, but you know, look, I'm not sure if he was pretending, you know, like everything is fine. Like I said, the serious point about Afghanistan, for all the talk about health care, for all the talk about these things, the White House knows that Afghanistan is this president's biggest problem, his biggest burden. So, you know, I was at a ceremony a week ago when he was giving his first Medal of Honor award, and just looking at the look on his face, he now owns this war. He knows that. And, you know, so I think a late-night appearance does not take that away. You know, but I think, speaking of Glenn Beck, I don't know what the crossover is, if any, between the Glenn Beck audience and the David Letterman show. Perhaps there's not much, but it's certainly a way for him to get out there and fill a bit of airtime, because this certainly has been played over and over and over on the morning news this morning. So I think the White House, thinks it was pretty good for them.
And Delaney, would you expect to see the president and future presidents making more appearances like this? Was it successful enough to be repeated?
Yeah, I think he'll probably do some more shows. I'm expecting to see him do a guest spot on Desperate Housewives this Sunday. So, no. but actually, NCIS said they'd like to actually have him as a guest star, so who knows? But no, he'll definitely stay on the talk show circuit because, like we said, he'll reach out to different audiences, the ones that aren't watching the hard-hitting news shows. And it wasn't all cupcakes and rainbows. He spoke about the economy, but he said unemployment is still low. So even though it was a happy show and it was comfortable and it was kind, he did say that things still do need to change.
Delaina Dixon, TV blogger and founder of DelainaDixon.com. Also, Jeff Zeleny, he's the White House reporter for our partner, The New York Times. We'll be right back.
And Todd Zwillick, Takeaways Washington correspondent, is down in Washington as the Senate Finance Committee takes center stage on the issue of health care reform. And Todd, a listener has a question for you.
Great.
Hi, my name is Amna, calling from New Jersey. I just have a question about the health care debate. Is there still a possibility that the public option will be included in the form of an amendment?
Well, Todd?
There's going to be an attempt. There are at least three public option amendments from the left side of the Democrats that we're expecting. Probably not today because that's not the part of the bill they're dealing with today, but this week certainly at least three. The question is whether they can get on the bill. All the Republicans are opposed and a couple of the moderate Democrats are as well. So then the question becomes, after those amendments, how do you bridge these liberal Democrats who won't vote for a bill that doesn't have the public option with a couple of the moderate Republicans who won't vote for a bill that does? And the answer is probably the most powerful person in Washington today. And it's not Barack Obama, John. It's Olympia Snow, Senator Olympia Snow from Maine. She is looking for a way to get on this bill. She is the only way Democrats can get 60 votes on this, which is still what they want. So later in the week, after all the public option amendments come up, Olympia Snow is going to have what's called a trigger. And a trigger will basically say, if costs don't come down a certain percentage, or if the plans available with no public option are too expensive for middle-income people, then this trigger will go into effect and there will be a public option. The one thing the liberals don't like about it, they say it doesn't go far enough, is because Olympia Snow's public option in her trigger is only statewide. 50 separate options, not one big one, which is what they want.
All right, we've got to go, but let's back up on that. The liberals are saying we have to have a public option, but the only way Olympia Snow is going to support it is if it's delayed unless certain financial circumstances are reached. That's the trigger?
Delayed and divided 50 ways, which is a lot less market clout. So can that bridge a gap between them? It really, you know, as the cliche goes, it remains to be seen. But that's a wide chasm right now. There has to be a lot of horse trading on other issues in this bill to see if people can get it, can get around the idea of this public option as the great divider here.
And they'll all be horse trading today in the Senate Finance Committee. Republican Senator Olympia Snow of Maine, just one of them. Max Baucus also, and the Liberal Democrats. Sounds like they're being listened to. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much for that.
My pleasure.
Louise Story now joins us, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. But today she has more of a business story. Louise, explain.
Well, Netflix, you know, they're the DVD rental company, finally announced the winner for their big contest they've been running for 3 years yesterday. And it was a contest to see who could come up with a better model, the best model, to predict what movies people would like. So you had all these statisticians and computer coders all over the world competing for this, and the prize was $1 million.
So they actually asked hackers and computer programmers all over the world to come up with a way of tracking people's purchases and giving them recommendations that they actually act on.
They gave them a huge data set. There were 100 million movie ratings in what they gave them, and then told them to try to come up with predictive models. The thing that interested me about this is when you look at what's happening in advertising and marketing, we're seeing more and more contests like this or on-the-ground stunts because companies are finding as they reach people directly, they get a lot more brand value than they do in some traditional advertising. So, you know, while there was only one team that won this, they had thousands that competed. Mm. And so all of those people might be more excited about Netflix. And then, you know, Netflix gets all this free news coverage, which is, you know, free, doesn't cost money like an ad, about this contest. So, one thing that's interesting about it to me is I think these sorts of things that are happening more and more are questioning a lot of the advertising model.
Not entirely free. It cost them $1 million.
Well, right, it cost them $1 million, but they got a model they might have had to pay, you know, a pricey technology consultant for. And again, in lieu of a marketing budget, it could have really big impact.
And the winner is not exactly an American Idol household name, but the winner?
Well, it was a group called Belcore's Pragmatic Chaos. So I told you there were some nerdy yeah. people. No offense to listeners out there, but there were some nerdy people at this contest. And so they merged their name into Belcore, and then Pragmatic Chaos is a reference to some things in mathematics.
And the engineers from the U.S., Austria, Canada, and Israel all be sharing that $1 million. Louise Story, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll get a final hit on sports with our Takeaway Sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We talked about football already this morning, but there's a baseball pennant race taking place, and it's tighter than we would expect.
Definitely. Baseball right now is in the playoff season. So there's October 7th is when it all begins. And so right now the Yankees and the Red Sox are actually in a race for the AL East.
It's suddenly getting close.
It's a little scary, I think, for Yankees fans, but for the Boston fans, the Boston has won 10 of their last 12 games. They're the hottest team in baseball right now. Their bullpen is really looking great, and they're hitting the ball really well. So I think Boston actually has an edge right now. And going into this weekend coming up, they have a week of games. They're going to be playing against each other, but also Boston has a weaker schedule for the end of the year. So they could conceivably win most of their games towards the end of the year.
And as recently as 2 weeks ago, the Yankees were not thinking that this Red Sox series was going to be that significant. Let's move to the AL Central.
Yeah, the AL Central is also where things were kind of wrapped up and Detroit kind of had it together. But all of a sudden, the Minnesota Twins are making a serious run for the title there.
And a short run, I'm sure.
Well, a short run.
Three games out.
Two and a half games out, actually, yeah. as of right now. And the Twins don't have the pitching to really push this through. That's where Detroit's strength, particularly with Verlander, isn't making that happen. But the Twins are definitely making a push, and they have to play each other again coming up in this week as well. So there's a lot of drama in baseball right now with people that are fighting for spots.
Do the San Francisco Giants have a prayer at this point?
Well, right now they're about 4.5 games out of the wild card. I would say that they're close, but they've lost key critical games down the stretch when it matters. The Colorado Rockies tooled up and they switched up their lineup last week. So they put people in different places, and that was actually a really smart decision, and it gave them the power and the hitting that pushed them to where they are right now.
Right. Finally, the NBA has apparently locked out its referees for the start of the preseason. What's going to happen, and could it delay the actual regular season?
It won't delay the actual start of the regular season. That's what we're hearing. But they're pulling in replacement referees, and they're mostly pulling in replacement referees from their system. So it's not as much, not like they're pulling guys from, like, your local high school team or, like, the Troy High team where I went to. They're not pulling the local guys from there. They're pulling in people that are part of their system and also people that they fired in the past. They're pulling them back on.
They're not calling you, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, talking about sports in the studio. Coming up, we'll talk more about Afghanistan and whether U.S. policy is really in flux. That's in a few minutes. So go apply for one of those ref jobs, Ibrahim.
That's a good idea. Good morning, everyone.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a policy in flux in Afghanistan, or is the White House preparing the way for announcing troop increases? We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following this morning at 32 minutes past the hour. President Obama is speaking about climate change at the United Nations. Later today, China will announce new plans to deal with its own carbon footprint. Also, President Obama will talk about the stalled Mideast peace process with Israeli and Palestinian leaders. Tonight, he'll speak at an event held by former President Clinton. In the southeast, heavy rainfall is creating epic flooding. At least 6 are dead across the region, most of them in the Atlanta area. Major roads in the area are shut down, and more rain is expected today.
Federal officials say a Colorado man in custody may have been plotting to set off backpack bombs on New York trains. Transit officials across the country are advised to step up patrols. The man's charged with lying to terror investigators. In healthcare, Senate Finance Chair Max Baucus is on the Hill right now as his colleagues meet to deal with his overhaul bill. He's already making some changes to draw support from critics. Watch for more developments on that later today. Finally, in Maine, a man who worked with wood found quite a surprise in his own family tree. A furniture worker there got tired of people telling him his co-worker looked like him, so he did some research. It turns out the two men are long-lost brothers. They were separated at birth 35 years ago when they were given up for adoption. Those are some of those stories we're watching this morning.
Well, President Obama spoke on the David Letterman show last night, and there was a lot of comedy on the program, but regarding Afghanistan, it wasn't a straight line and it wasn't a punchline. Obama went directly to the idea of why America is in Afghanistan.
What we can't lose sight of is the fact that the reason we went there in the first place
And the number one threat that we continue to face is that you've got a group of extremists who are willing to slaughter innocents and are targeting this country. And my job as commander-in-chief is to make sure that they are destroyed, their networks are dismantled, and that they can't pose a threat to the United States of the sort that we saw here in New York.
President speaking on Afghanistan on the Letterman show last night, but have we lost sight of the clarity of the mission in Afghanistan? Listen to Mary Galletti, who spoke on this program earlier this morning. Her husband, Russell, is going to be deployed to Afghanistan in January. Is she clear on what we're doing in Afghanistan? Listen.
I think a big piece of this problem is linked to the fact that there's not a lot of clarity as to what the mission is in Afghanistan. If you were to ask the average American, what's the mission in Afghanistan, they'd probably respond, to win, which is true. However, what that means is still a little murky.
So the people who are deploying to Afghanistan wonder if Americans understand what the mission is. Here in the studio with me in WGBH in Boston, our partner station up in Boston, is Charlie Sennett, the executive editor of Global Post, which has its headquarters here in Boston. Good morning, Charlie.
Morning.
So you've got the president saying we can't lose sight of the fact that this is all about attacking al-Qaeda, yet you've got somebody whose husband is deploying, shipping out for Afghanistan, wondering if Americans have a clue as to what we're doing there. That disparity is mirrored on the ground in Afghanistan as well.
Yeah, that disparity is so well captured in those two pieces of tape, because that was an applause line last night for President Obama when he said that. Yet the clarity comes from, you know, this military family, and that's what you hear on the ground. When you're in Afghanistan talking to the troops, that lack of clarity is just coursing through everything they tell you on the ground. The mission is not clear. They're very confused themselves. I don't think an increase of troops is going to do anything to reduce that confusion, and I think clarity has to come before there is really this call for more troops. I just don't think that the Democrats themselves are going to buy it.
Well, if you're in a war, you got to know who you're shooting at. What do troops refer to as the enemy over there? Is it the Taliban? Is it al-Qaeda?
Well, one of my favorite phrases you hear on the ground is ACM. What does that mean?
ACM.
That's the anti-coalition militia, sir.
Oh, no, really?
What does that mean?
Sort of the IED acronym.
Yeah, so it's a military acronym spoken from a FOB, or forward operating base, where they're called FOBistan, because they're hermetically sealed inside the FOB. They have no sense of who the enemy is in the hills, so they refer to them as ACM.
And it could be Taliban.
It could be
al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda.
It could be
Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's people, who are right on the Pakistan border. This could be just a tribal militia affiliated with an angry warlord who wants a better piece of the pie from the U.S. Dole out of cash in Afghanistan. The confusion on the ground is that we are neither suited enough right now in terms of troop ratios. You know, the actual force ratios on the ground could never stop an insurgency. You'd have to have it way too high to do that.
Which is why McChrystal wants more troops.
And there's exactly. And then there's insufficient troops as well to accomplish the mission of rebuilding the institutions for democracy. And those troops that are there, part of the mini surge that President Obama announced back in March, which is now just completing and bringing it to 68,000 troops on the ground. That amount doesn't really allow them to fulfill the mission of building the institutions of democracy, as we saw in the failed election. So, I mean, we are really in between a rock and a hard place there, and I don't see how we are going to have any clarity about whether or not we even need more troops until we clarify the mission. I think that woman was right on the money.
But those are the problems presidents get, the hard ones, where you're between a rock and a hard place. A lot of people have compared Afghanistan to Vietnam. Are there other scenarios that are cautionary tales about what happens if you make a wrong turn in Afghanistan?
Afghanistan is just littered with graveyards that tell the history of that place and what happens to empires who try to go there. And it is always just surprising to me that the Obama administration, with all of these smart policy thinkers, these generals who are our best and brightest, like Petraeus and McChrystal, that they don't see.
And you've talked with these people.
I've talked with Petraeus. I've had a chance to interview General Petraeus probably six or seven times. On Iraq, they had really some deep insights and some successes. On Afghanistan, they're trying to bring the same playbook, and it won't work. And the sad part is, I don't know if Vietnam is exactly the right comparison. A worse potential comparison is that Obama could not be the LBJ of this Vietnam, but he could actually be the Gorbachev of Afghanistan.
I mean, Gorbachev, who was the Soviet leader at the end of that invasion.
At the tail end of a nine-year experience for the Soviet forces in Afghanistan, where they left in defeat and it crumbled their empire.
And indeed, that plays into the argument that Lawrence Korb made on this program earlier, and we've got to go, and that is the power vacuum in Afghanistan is a threat to the entire world. Do U.S. forces believe that? Do you believe that? And do people in Afghanistan believe that?
I think U.S. forces on the ground know that. I believe that from my reporting there. The policy people need to catch up with that historic reality of Afghanistan.
And how much time do we have before America turns away from this war?
Well, I think the American public is already turning away, and I think, very importantly, so are leading Senate Democrats. And one big one to watch now will be John Kerry. John Kerry came onto the scene, you remember, when he was a college student, speaking out against the Vietnam War,
right,
and he testified before the Foreign Relations Committee about that war. Who will be the last to die for this war? And now he will hold hearings in which this war in Afghanistan will bring forth those people who will now critique a new war. And I think that's really the one to watch, Senate Foreign Relations.
He's got boots on the ground in Afghanistan. Charlie Sennett is the executive editor of Global Post. Go to globalpost.com to see their reporting on Afghanistan. Charlie, thanks so much for being
with
us.
Thanks, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
From the air, Camp Bukka, far out in the desert near the Iraqi border with Kuwait, looks like a town with grid-patterned streets. But as you get closer, you see rows and rows of huts, dozens of watchtowers, compounds surrounded by razor wire.
That was BBC correspondent in Baghdad, Hugh Sykes, describing the scene of the largest American internment camp in Iraq, Camp Bukka, as he flew over it in a helicopter. He joined us earlier this morning, and I started the conversation by asking him why he was flying over the camp.
We're flying into it, in fact, flying over it before landing in the middle of it because it was closing down. Camp Bukka was the largest American internment camp in Iraq. There are three main camps. There were three main camps. There are now two. The two remaining are at Taji and Cropper near Baghdad here. At its peak, Camp Bukka held 22,000 people without charge, without trial, suspected insurgents, people like that. There are still 8,305 such people at Camps Cropper and Taji, which I think interestingly compares to the total number of detainees still interned in Guantanamo Bay, which is just 295.
What happened to those 22,000 who are at Camp Bukka?
They were released without charge because it was decided that there was no case against them and they probably hadn't done anything. And if they had done something, it was fairly minor. So the American authorities thought it was safe to release them. There's some controversy. There was a huge double bomb explosion here in Baghdad on August the 19th at the Interior Ministry and one other location. And there were some rumors and suspicions that the bombs were planted and detonated by prisoners who had been released without trial. But I did ask General David Quantock, who's in charge of all detainee operations here in Iraq, about that. And he said there's absolutely no evidence that those bombs were caused and created by anybody who'd been released from camps. And in fact, the American view here is that those explosions, those murders of more than 100 people and scores more who were injured were actually carried out by Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Hugh, Iraq is a sovereign nation. So why are these Iraqi citizens being held by U.S. troops? Why haven't we handed them over to Iraqi authorities?
It's a slow process. It can't happen overnight. There'd be total chaos if it did happen overnight. There was something called the Security Agreement, which was signed and agreed between Iraq and the United States, which came into force on the 1st of January this year. And this slow prisoner transfer to the Iraqi authorities is taking place under the terms of the Security Agreement, which has been agreed between the two countries. And the crucial detail is that by sometime in 2010, the Americans have to hand over all the remaining detainees to the Iraqi authorities or release them. And those they do hand over, they have to hand them over with enough evidence to stand up in court for them to face trial. And if they can't assemble enough evidence for that, they all have to be released.
So Hugh Sykes, BBC Baghdad correspondent, very, very quickly, did you speak with any of the people that had been released? What were their feelings toward their detainment?
I spoke to one former Camp Bukka detainee, and he was held for 3 years without trial. So many of them have been held for that long. He was eventually released. No evidence against him. He was accused of killing people as part of the sectarian killing campaign here. He said he never did anything of the sort. All he did was support the resistance by being a supporter of Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mehdi army. Army. So no case against him, he says.
That was BBC correspondent in Baghdad, Hugh Sykes, who joined us earlier this morning.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And I'm John Huckenberry up here at WGBH in Boston with Celeste Headlee down in New York. Coming up, how a proliferation of Alzheimer's cases could affect the global healthcare system. More on that in just a few minutes. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following this morning at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama is speaking right now about climate change at the United Nations. This as China is expected to make a major announcement on its own plans to tackle the problem. President Obama is later going to meet with China's president, Hu Jintao. He's also meeting with Israeli and Palestinian leaders to try to kickstart the Middle East peace process. We'll hear some voices on that in just a moment. More rain on the way for the flood-soaked southeast. Six are dead. Most of them in the Atlanta area. The waters have totally submerged cars and shut down major roads.
On Capitol Hill right now, senators are working on a health care bill from Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus. Baucus has already made some changes to get more support, and more will probably come today. The Obama administration is warning insurance companies they could face legal action for allegedly trying to scare seniors with misleading information on a health care overhaul. The warning was sent to firms that sell private Medicare coverage to seniors. Security officials say a Colorado man held as part of a terror probe may have plotted with others to bomb New York trains. Mass transit officials across the country have been warned to step up security. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, as we mentioned, President Obama has a busy day at the United Nations. Among the meetings he's going to have is a way to restart Mideast peace negotiations, meeting with Israeli and Palestinian leaders at the United Nations. We wanted to give you a quick sense of what Israelis and Palestinians are expecting from today's talks. They're certainly paying attention. Our partners at the BBC have voices of people on the streets of Jerusalem. This from BBC's reporter Bethany Bell. Listen.
Ben Yehuda Street, with its cobblestone paving and pretty little boutique shops, feels a long way from New York. And as the shoppers pause at the jewellery shops or stop for coffee or fruit juice at the outdoor cafes, there's a very low sense of expectation. But some people are just allowing themselves to hope.
It's good. It will make things move. Things are stuck here for 50 years, not moving, more than 60 years. And we need a lot of help here because it's a very complicated situation and people here are way too deep inside their problems.
An Israeli voice from Jerusalem there. And what about in Palestinian areas? Here's the BBC's John Donison from the West Bank town of Ramallah with some Palestinian voices about whether they feel optimistic.
No, not really optimistic, because like hundreds of times they meet for the last 20 or 30 years and always they said it's going to be okay. They open a few checking points or something, but we need like real result.
Has anything changed since the arrival of President Obama?
No, not at all.
Not for the way you live?
No, not at all.
Optimism and pessimism from voices in Israel and Palestine this morning. We're going to be following this story throughout the week. Celeste?
Well, the new pretty large wrinkle has appeared in the healthcare debate. We found out from the World Alzheimer's Day report that within 20 years, the number of people on the planet with dementia will probably double. That means around 70 million people around the globe will have dementia by 2030. Most likely means they're going to have Alzheimer's. It's a public health crisis looming over us. Our next guest says this has already begun to affect our healthcare system. That guest is David Schenck. David is a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and author of the book The Forgetting, Alzheimer's Portrait of an Epidemic. You actually published that book in 2001, so it almost seems you're a bit prescient there when you are already talking about an epidemic that we're getting reports on now.
Yeah, well, everyone, unfortunately, this is not new news to people in the Alzheimer's community. We have known this is coming for a long, long time, and we could have done more about it in advance. But now we're still trying to raise the alarm for the public that we need to get more serious about this disease.
So explain this. How is dementia different from the normal loss of memory that people have as they age?
Right. Everyone in their 30s and 40s is starting to feel that they're not as sharp as they were in their 20s. That's normal. That's going to happen to everyone. Then there's this disease called Alzheimer's disease and some related diseases that cause senile dementia that are a very, very different ballgame. These are progressive brain diseases that last 10 to 15 years and are ultimately fatal.
Okay, joining us from Philadelphia is Renee Packle. She's a 73-year-old. You're caring for your husband, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 9 years ago. You just heard David talk about the erosion of memory and of thought processes. Can you tell us what's happened with your husband?
Well, he was an attorney. He was a very, very brilliant man. Now he's just a shell. He really cannot follow any conversation. He just has lost words and he can't understand a normal conversation. It moves too fast for him. He can't see a glass in front of him because it doesn't just affect your memory. It affects how you see, how you think. He basically has to be cared for all the time.
So tell me what your day is like.
I send him to daycare. I get up about 5 o'clock in the morning. I change his diaper, help him brush his teeth. I help him get his clothes on. He's liable to put on one sock and one shoe, not on different feet. He just doesn't understand. So he has to be watched or helped constantly. And then I send him off to daycare so that I can go to work. And there he spends the day. He has activities. I know he's safe and cared for and fed, so I can go to work with some peace of mind.
Well, we can certainly hear, Renee Packle, how this really is a central feature of your life. And if you scale that up to 35 million people who will have similar issues in their families as this takes hold, it motivates a question to David Shank. David, you mentioned at the outset that we could have done more, that this isn't a surprise in the Alzheimer's community. What do you mean we could have done more? You mean in research to find a cure or in developing an infrastructure to deal with the kinds of problems that Renee Packle has to deal with basically on her own?
Well, it's both, but it's particularly the research, because we have to get the political will and spend more money nationally and internationally to cure this disease. People need to understand there's a lot of money already going into it, and we are making some progress, but we could have made more progress in the last 10 years.
Well, it's a very expensive disease. Research tells us it costs $315 billion a year worldwide. In the U.S., it's more than $100 billion a year. And since we're having a debate nationally about health care reform, are you looking at different reforms that could help maybe manage the cost of treating this disease better, David?
Well, unfortunately, one thing's not going to change about Alzheimer's disease unless we do something to cure it or really slow it down. It's a 10 to 15 year disease. It's very, very expensive. It's not only devastating to families, it's very, very expensive for families, and it's expensive nationally. Really, the answer here is we have to develop the political will to put more money into research. We're only spending a couple hundred million dollars on Alzheimer's research. That compares to over $1 billion for cancer research. And, you hate to compare diseases, but Alzheimer's is really not getting the funding it deserves, sadly.
Renee, somehow are you piecing together to be able to afford the care for your husband?
Well, I'm helped out by the Veterans Administration. Everything else is mine, all the diapers and supplies that he needs. And if I want to go out anywhere, I have to get a sitter for him. And I've been looking into assisted living for him. It's $6,000 a month. I cannot afford that.
Do you have other family members that can help you out?
Financially, not really. They've got children in college. So it's really hard. It's hard on the entire family. The children do help me out when they can.
So, David, a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, what is driving this rise in dementia cases? Why are we going to see so many more?
Well, it's very simple. This is a disease that's existed as long as human beings have, but only in the last 100 years have we figured out how to live longer, effectively as a civilization. So it's every year after 65 that we live, our risks of getting Alzheimer's and these other dementias grows enormously. So, and there's nothing that we can do about those risks except for do more research to come up with a cure or a prevention.
David Shank, correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, also author of the book The Forgetting: Alzheimer's Portrait of an Epidemic. We also heard from Renee Packle from Philadelphia. She's the caregiver for her husband who's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, it's a great takeaway that what this is really about is figuring out our responsibilities in the end of life as people live longer and longer, dementia being one of them. So you can hear that interview again, catch up on anything you missed, go to our podcast to go. You can subscribe at thetakeaway.org. President Obama is still speaking at the United Nations about climate change and how Washington is moving to catch up on the problem. We'll keep watching that, and later China is going to speak and offer its solution to climate change. We're also talking about how after his media blitz, you might say the president is a little overexposed on television. What do you think? Should he go on another show or scrap the shows altogether and just get back to the White House?
I don't think Obama should be doing as many television shows and interviews. He sounds like a vacuum cleaner salesman. And I don't think no matter how many interviews or vacuum cleaner pitches he makes to the public, nobody's going to buy this socialized medicine tax raising scam of his.
And there were some other media advisors out there. Here's another one.
I think Obama is overexposing himself. He should be working hard trying to convince politicians and the Republicans to get aboard his health care plan.
Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm up in Boston today, but I'll be back in New York, Celeste, getting on the train in a couple of hours.
Well, travel well. I'm Celeste Headlee in New York.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks, of course, to our partners WGBH in Boston. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.